Hello and welcome back to another episode of Anarcho Book Club. So today you may have noticed things sound a little different. That's because I'm using FFmpeg now for recording. And it's not something against Audacity exactly, but it's more I'm trying to make things simpler. I'm not going to be editing anymore, really. I may apply filters or something, but I'm maybe normalize the audio a bit, but I'm not going to be editing really anymore. So you may hear quite a few pauses, and that is because sometimes whenever I'm recording, I have to stop and think about how I'm going to say something. It's usually only a second or two, but I just wanted to warn you ahead of time. So what I'm going to be doing is today we're going to try to cover as much as possible of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, because I've missed 3 weeks now, as you may have noticed, and, well, I'd like to get through as much of it as possible. I have more things I want to read, and I've actually already finished the book. I've been going back through and notating things as if you've not noticed, I've been trying to put up the chapters on the website so that you can follow along, but in the end I may make an EPUB or something, I don't know, it depends on how much trouble I'll get in, but I've been kind of going through it again, making notes, and I have gotten most of my note-taking done, even though I took the last 3 weeks off of recording. So, well, let's just kind of dive into it, because we're going to go through it kind of quickly, because I've noticed as I was taking notes, there are a lot of things I could say about it, but there are a few high points. And first off, so we're on chapter 2 of the first part. And I want to get through this one pretty quickly because it's basically the hero journey. Well, the whole thing is the hero journey, but this is like the beginning, the build up, and there are a few high points I want to touch on. And one of those high points is starting with let me just pull it up here. One of those high points is where we're at now. The trials of the hero. And that's always the beginning. And you see this in King Arthur stories. You see this in the story of Jesus in the Bible. You see this in all sorts of different stories. Hold on, coffee break. So, and these are just the trials. And in European mythology, there's this trial of going into the woods. In fact, it's all over all mythology, but it's more prominent, I think, in European mythology. And that's the mythology I studied more than anything in college. And that's another thing I want to address before we really dive into this. I have received a few, comments about, I guess in a past episode I may have claimed, well, it may have sounded like I claimed that I had something to do with linguistics. And that's not true. If I led you to believe that, then I am sorry. But it's not exactly true. So I studied linguistics at university, but it wasn't my focus. My focus was mythology, in fact. It was mythological literature and the languages around it. And so what I actually studied was something called philology. And that is more of a sociological study of language. You might think of it that way. And it's the language within mythology that I specifically studied. In fact, if I were doing some sort of a webcam sort of podcast or whatever, I don't even know what you would call that. But if I was doing like videos for LBRY or YouTube with my face, you would see in the background all of the books that I have accumulated over the years, and many of them, if you look closely, have more to do with the linguistics around mythology than mythology itself. And that's because as you dive into mythology, you'll notice these things that Campbell is talking about. You'll notice that there is a certain type of language used in mythology. And a lot of it, in my experience, or at least from what I've learned, has to do with the fact that a lot of it was memorized, and or, well, maybe not even memorized, but it was, these are stories that were passed along generation by generation without ever writing them down. In the Völuspá, or the, well, more widely, the Poetic Edda, or the Elder Edda, the Codex Regis, as it is called by the academic community, that one, it was written down by command of the king of Iceland at the time, or the, I don't know if you'd call him a king, but it was written down at the behest of some leader or ruler. But before it was written down, it was passed along generation to generation, and the Grimm brothers, the who is it, Johann and Jacob Grimm, they came up with this, I think it's three, no, it's four books, or a four-volume set, which I have, called Teutonic Mythology. You'd think after the weeks and weeks worth of hours that I've spent in those books, I would remember what they're called, but I don't, unfortunately, sometimes. So they wrote these books, Teutonic Mythology, and it reads like a dictionary almost. Almost. Now, each section or each paragraph, it reads like a paragraph, but they just go through every word and how they compare to other versions of the language, like the Gothic, the Old High German, the Old Low German, the more modern languages of their time, and English, Anglo-Saxon, all of these different, Icelandic, all of these different languages. They go through and they compare the words, including Latin. And that's where I first kind of discovered, even though I'm sure it was already well known, that a lot of the Germanic words that we think of as Germanic actually come from Latin. A lot of the mythology seemed to come from the Greek mythology and the Roman mythology. A lot of the mythology of the Teutons, or the Scandinavians and Northern Germans, came from those, it seemed. But something that Campbell is pointing out here in his book is simply the stories that we see from all over the world. It's a singular vision of a hero. The hero with a thousand faces. The hero who takes the face of Arthur, Jesus, the Buddha, all of these different heroes that we see, Sigurd, Beowulf, all of these different heroes. It's a singular idea, or at least there's a singular idea behind each one of these hero stories. And to kind of restate, I guess, what I've probably already said in the past, the fact that these all have a similar theme to them, the trials, the goddess, the, you know, all of these different things, the vengeful father, as it were, the all of these different memes that encompass the hero. The fact that there are these things don't make these stories falsehood. They simply are the perception of those telling them. The perception of the one who first saw these stories play out in real time. They more than likely told the story that they saw, and maybe it had some embellishments, but they saw something play out, and it was wild enough, it was heroic enough, that they remembered it, and they told their children. And their children told their children, because this is a story that continues on and on. And it's a story that you see again and again. You see the story of the hero, or you hear the story of the hero, and then you see it play out. And you disregard some of the facts, some of the ideas, because they're not as important to the archetypal theme which stands out, which gives you some sort of a hope or some sort of a passion to do good or to do something great. And so the hero's story always starts out with the trials. Or so it seems. Or at least this segment of the hero's story starts out with the trials. And in Northern Germanic mythology, it's going into the woods. In, well, actually, just almost every mythology over Europe, you go into the dark woods. And that's because there was a time, perhaps before written history, but I don't think so. I think even Tacitus, I think it was, who wrote about this, the conquest of Gaul. Even he mentions the great and deep and dark forest that they encountered. And they encountered it somewhere far closer to Rome than what we may think of the Black Forest today. Because it was the Black Forest that they're talking about. And it stretches far and wide. And archaeologists and geographers have posited that it probably stretched somewhere from the English Isles all the way across Europe, somewhere close to Afghanistan of today, or at least to the mountain range in Afghanistan. And it was deep too. It went from way up northern Germany all the way down to the Alps at one point. Eventually it was beaten back by settlements or by some sort of temperature change caused the trees to slowly grow thinner and thinner. But this looming black forest that the hero journeys into, it was present and it was real. And it transformed it formed the myths of the hero's journey. And it was the beginning of a lot of the trials for heroes. But then we go on to the meeting with the goddess, which is section 2. And the goddess is this motherly figure, this woman, goddess-like, surpassing beauty and surpassing all sorts of ugliness. And that means that her beauty is great, and her ugliness can also be great. And it's impressive how ugly or beautiful this goddess could be. And this is where the hero has a choice to make. Two paths. The hero's path can split in one of two ways. Either he can help this ugly crone of a woman and be rewarded, or he can shun her and be met with more trials down the road. It is the image, this is the image, as Campbell says, let me just quote him. Woman, in the picture language of mythology, represents the totality of what can be known. That is the totality, that is everything. In the Arthur story, there is a crone, but in the Arthur story, what stands out most to me is the Lady of the Lake, surpassing all beauty, and gives Arthur the heroic sword Excalibur. That is the image, the goddess. In fairy tales, that is the fairy queen. The one who rules over death and life. In Norse myth, or northern myths, Scandinavian myths, that is the fates. In that case, it's three women. And they surpass all beauty, and they surpass all ugliness in the same way. But they also decide the fate of the hero in every case. And I don't want to pause too long on this, but this... let's go on to the next section, though, because the next section is the woman as the temptress. And this is always in myth. In Sigurd and Gudrun, you had... Or Sigurd... The Sigurd myth, you had Gudrun and Brunhilde. And I believe it was Brunhilde who was the prize. It was the one that Sigurd battled up a hill and freed her from the imprisonment that Odin put her in. Think of the classic, Disney story of Sleeping Beauty, because that's what it is. Except slightly different, of course. Because Brunhilde, she was imprisoned in a tower of shields, shining shields. And she was asleep within this tower of shields. And Sigurd battled his way up and freed her from it. And pulled her out. And they fought side by side. And then after his journey, after his trials, and after her trials in that case. And that's one thing I will mention. In a lot of the Norse myths, or the Icelandic myths, unlike other myths throughout the world, unlike a lot of the myths that Campbell mentions, there's not as strong a separation between female and male in role playing. But we'll touch on that later. But then comes the womanist temptress. You have Gudrun in this myth, later on in the myth, because it's a whole separate story. And she becomes the temptress for Sigurd. And eventually they, well, basically run off together, as it were. And for in biblical myth, there is David, King David, the mighty king, the one who slayed Goliath, the one who led Israel to greatness. And he is a womanist temptress. And I was hoping I would remember her name by the time I got to this point. It's been a long time since I've read that story. Let's see. Let me just look it up, actually, because I'm not going to just... I'll just forget altogether. Let's see. King David Temptation. That looks like a good search. King David caught in the tempter's trap, faces sexual torment. Oh, all kinds of fun little searches here. Story concerns King David. What is her name? What is her name? Michael? No, that's not it. That was Saul's daughter. Pleasures of Sin. Okay. I can't remember her name, but this is bugging me so much. This is something I would normally cut out. I would just pause the video, pause the recording, and look it up. Oh, Bathsheba! I should have remembered that because she was taking a bath, and that's how he saw her. Bathsheba. Of course, Bible.org says Bathsheba was not guiltless either. She may have purposefully enticed David. But as I have studied this story in depth, in fact, and I don't think that's true, to be honest with you. So anyway, Bathsheba, she's taking a bath. David peered out from his mighty hall, as it were, his mighty palace, and he saw her naked, taking a bath, and he decided he wants her. She was the temptress for him. He had her husband killed, in fact, so that he could have her. He gets her pregnant, too, by the way, which, that's great. At first they try to deceive her husband, and that doesn't work, because he wouldn't sleep with her. And so David put him on the front lines and had him killed, so that people would think that is not his child. But either way, this is his temptress, Bathsheba. And now there are others as well. There's throughout all of myth. I would highly encourage you, I don't know if I've ever recommended this before, but there's a book called the Shahnameh, the Persian Book of Kings. There are multiple stories in this where there is a hero journey and there is a woman as temptress. And this is where I wanted to get into it a little bit more, into the role-playing of women and men. Because in mythology, if you would please disregard the whole gender theory section or part of this, just for the sake of simplifying it a bit. Men are almost always the hero of the story. Women are generally the helper women take multiple roles in these stories. They're either the helper, or the temptress, or the almighty goddess mother. The one who controls fate. The one who controls your life, your death, and everything. And that goes for Greek myth. That goes, you know, it goes for all sorts of myths. But, and of course, there are exceptions. I'm not saying every single myth will have this specific theme. But there are exceptions. But, for the most part, myth has these parts to it. And it's important to realize, because I think it's something deep within us that believes these things, or that may realize these and write them into our myths. Because if you think back, or well, I don't suppose you can think back, but if you accept the story told to us of how man has come and evolved over time, man and woman, mankind as it were, you will see that men were always the ones going out to hunt, going out to fight, going out away from the home to do something to make life better for his family unit, or for his tribe, or, you know, what have you. Men have always been the disposable one, the one that fights in battles. And that's because of possibly their natural physique. Because men naturally will have higher muscle density, higher bone density, and seem to be built for this sort of thing genetically. And this is, I think, over years and years, or millennia, as it were, of breeding for this. And women tend to be the gatherers, the protectors of the home, the ones who sort of rule the home, rule the homestead. They are the ones who tend to work behind the scenes for the society, and sometimes more in a forward manner as well. And this, historically, this is the case. And then men go off, they hunt, they fight, they do whatever they do, they come back with the spoils of war, the spoils of the hunt, and present it to their female counterparts. And then the female counterparts generally throughout history took care of the distribution of this wealth or food or whatever it was. And I think that's built into myth. It's an integral part of myth, because myths are something older than history. Myths are things that each and every one of us, if you really, really connect with them, if you really study the myth, if you really, maybe you have to find a myth that connects with you better, but you'll feel it deep within you. And that's why movies such as Star Wars can become so popular, because they embody these mythical themes, these mythical archetypes so very well. And Lord of the Rings as well. Of course, that was sort of an imitation of myth. So, and maybe that's what Star Wars was as well. But it was more of a Tolkien study of mythology, I think. And philology. So, you have all of that wrapped up in this, with the woman as temptress. But then we have apotheosis. Now, apotheosis is a fun one, because this is sort of what I wanted to focus on this episode, really. Because apotheosis is the achievement of some higher plane of thought, higher way of thinking. This is the achievement of the hero when the hero has come to an understanding of what his path truly is, of what his path can, why his path is more important than his own life. In fact, when the hero achieves apotheosis, the hero realizes that his life doesn't mean much at all, in fact, in the grand scheme of things. It seems to be, to me at least, that apotheosis is when the hero and the mother goddess have become unified in their ideals, have become unified in their thought. And maybe that's where Freud gets this idea, because the mother goddess, obviously with mother as a primary binding for this character. The mother goddess and the hero oftentimes will mingle in some sort of sexual intercourse or sexual struggle. And I don't know if actually Campbell touches on that, but that's one thing that kind of comes up whenever I'm thinking about these things. Maybe that's where Freud got his ideas, and not... Actually, I shouldn't say maybe, because I know that's where he gets his ideas of the... what we think of as the Oedipus and Vixen complexes. Is it called Vixen I say that, and it rolls off the tongue as if that's what it is, but I'm not sure if that's what it is. Anyway, that's the Oedipus complex that he outlines. He gets it straight from mythology, and that's where a lot of psychologists of his day got things, like Jung. Very, very in-depth studies of psychology and myth and the origin of psychological developments. But that, so the apotheosis, though, is that reaching. And so what does that mean for anarchists in that sense? What does it mean to reach apotheosis as someone who is anarchist? And the best way I can maybe describe this is, because whenever I say anarchist, I hope I communicate well enough to know, for you to know, that whenever I say anarchist, I simply mean human. Human who is free, or a human being who has decided to become, to stop allowing their life to be ruled by others, and to rule their own life, to take hold of their own life, to become something, to become the hero of their own story. Because to an anarchist, what this means, apotheosis would be... let me put it this way. So apotheosis is this realization. And they see this goal, this end goal, and they see where they're coming from. They're fighting the dragon of their past. They're fighting the dragon who is behind them. And that dragon is the government. But it's also... there's another part to this, of the section, the atonement with the father. The dragon is the father, the vengeful father, the vengeful, violent, wrathful father, the patriarchal father, who rules over the anarchist. That is what they're fighting against. That's what they're running from. And they reach apotheosis with the mother goddess. What is the mother goddess, then, to the anarchist? Well, let's say you're an agorist. Or perhaps maybe a minimalist, anarcho-minimalist? Is that a thing? I think it is. Let's say you're something of that nature, where you reduce your own consumption of goods to a point where you have what you need, you have what you want, but you've reduced your wants to a certain point. Let's just take me, for instance. Let's say I am just an anarchist, but I do like the minimalist point of view and the agorist point of view, which I see them as very, very similar in some ways. And that is, so right now, producing this podcast is this beast of a machine that sometimes works really well and sometimes doesn't. So my desk has a cabinet for storing your desktop computer. And it fills the entire thing completely. It's not meant to. In fact, I can barely reach in and hit the power button if I ever need to, because it's so close to the top of the desk, or to the desktop part of it. And one day I would like to have a small desk with a computer that is about the size of a Pine 64 board, if you know what that is. In fact, I have one. Excuse me. I have one. Right here. You can hear it's in a metal case, I hope. And it's ready to be used as a desktop computer. It has a gigabit Ethernet slot on it here. Port, as it were. HDMI port. I would like to be able to get rid of my computer and just use this and power it with a solar panel that I have. I got it for free, in fact. I've been testing the solar panel, and It is able to power 3 or 4 of these right now. Currently, it is powering 3 or 4 of these little Rock Pro 64 boards in their own plastic cases. And each one of them is running... I say 3 or 4, it's actually just 4. Each one is running a separate server for me. So it's running all the time. Always kind of doing something. And so it's I think it's probably a good judge. The solar panel I have, it's a small one, but it's able to power those 4, plus my router and modem, plus my switch, because I have a networking switch. All of these things it's able to power, and it's still, throughout the day, filling up the... I have 3 batteries that I'm also powering. It keeps them full at all times. Overnight, one of those batteries only drains about... the tool I'm using to measure it is very good, but it roughly drains it about 33%. It says 33%. I don't think that's right. That's too perfect of a number for it to be correct. So, but let's just say 2 of the batteries never drain. They never lose charge. They're always keeping trickle charged, and they stay charged. So I have theoretically achieved it, almost. But if I were able to achieve that, then my computing setup would use no power outside of what I can produce myself. And that's the agorist part of this. And the minimalist part is minimizing the impact of my technology, the technology I'm using. And if I could reach a state where I could minimalize all of that so that there's nothing that I use, and I achieve a certain goal, or I'm able to achieve, I can see the goal and achieve it. Apotheosis would be me achieving that goal, minimizing my impact, my technological impact on my own environment, and, well, basically seeing that goal of the mother goddess, so in my case, a lower footprint, carbon footprint, as it were, a lower desk footprint, because just think, this little board, it's about this, a little bit bigger than a, well, no, it's actually quite big. It looks like, in the case, it's about the size of an old, one of those old gray Game Boys. Yeah, that's a good description of it, I think, in the case. And that would be able to do as much or more as my current computer, I think, with a few small problems. But apotheosis would be me achieving that goal of self-sustainability for the agorist side. For the minimalist side, minimizing my footprint. And it seems like a never-ending goal, but when you finally reach that goal, when you finally have something, and then in your life, my house becoming completely efficient, self-sufficient, the entire living environment, and then my entire life becoming as that, very efficient, with almost no footprint in the world. That would be achieving apotheosis, I think. But for most anarchists, apotheosis is the mother goddess in the sky far away, and they're always working towards it. And the hero takes charge, and he faces the trials. And that's what I must do, in fact, to switch from this massive desktop to a small computer. The hero must take charge, face trials. And this isn't really a good example, I guess, but it's a peaceful example, if nothing else, and go forward and achieve that. And I think that may be a good enough example of this. It's something, it is a worldview that you're trying to achieve and actually live out. And once you've achieved it, and once you're living your worldview, or what your idealized worldview is, then you have reached apotheosis, and now you can go forward and do battle with the demons or with the dragons. And that brings us to atonement with the Father, because to slay the dragon is not enough. Not for the anarchist. See, our demons, our dragons, are those that would rule over us. And that could be the government itself, which is an obvious one, an easy one to pick out, an easy one to point fingers at. But it's also those that, like, the big mega corporations that seem to have gained some sort of control over everyone. And that's why agorism really sticks out to me as an ideal, as a mother goddess, as it were. Because we've become so reliant on these corporations, on these companies. It would be good to free ourselves of that. I think that is one of my goals, in fact, to free myself from these corporations and to free myself from the government in the end. And that is the vengeful father that we must strike down. But it's the atonement with the father that matters, because once you've raised yourself... Excuse me, I need another drink here. Once you've raised yourself to that level of heroic apotheosis, then you are equal to all of those. You are equal to Jeff Bezos. If you think of Jeff Bezos as some great and mighty person, then you still haven't faced enough trials. You haven't reached apotheosis. You haven't reached that enlightenment to know, to really, and this is the thing, you can't just know and say to yourself that you know this. You have to know it, like, deep down. And this is where myth is helpful, because many times in myth, the hero thinks he knows something. The hero thinks he is the hero, but he hasn't become that yet, because he hasn't reached apotheosis. He doesn't feel it deep within him that he is the equal to someone like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or the President of the United States. He hasn't realized that he is equal to the mayor of his town, if not better than. And those are loaded words, I know, but it's the easiest way I can communicate it, I think. Because that is just a man. Jeff Bezos is simply a man. Sundar Pichai of Google is simply a man. And the more we look at them and say, yes, but they are powerful, that shouldn't matter to the anarchist. They are powerful. They have something that seems to signify power. But you can take that power. That's what they're so afraid of, that you can take that power away from them. Simply by choosing to. Simply by going through the trials and reaching apotheosis. Now, this isn't the end goal, though, you see. Because we're still only in chapter 2. Because atonement with the Father... I'll just read something that... let's see. Campbell suggests... here. Well, so the father is this ogre father, the source of mighty power, as opposed to the goddess mother, who is the source of compassionate strength. But the father is this ogre father, and you must reach atonement. That doesn't mean, so in the Christian mythology, that is to bow down before the father and accept the chains. But for the anarchist, that means to rise up to the level of the father. Think of John Milton and Paradise Lost. Lucifer is thrown out of heaven, but he seeks to rise up to the power of the Father. To rise up against the Father in such a way, not to destroy the Father, but to show the Father that he is equal. And there's nothing that the Father can do, the ogre can do, to strike him down. He doesn't have a chokehold upon Lucifer. So these are just things that the anarchist should think about as he or she reads through this book. And because that does wrap up chapter 2, if I'm not wrong. Let me just double check here. It does wrap up chapter 2. Leads us into chapter 3, The Return, which Let me just check my time. Let's see what I've got here. Ooh. Man, we're at 40 minutes. So I've already recorded this once, and then I listened to it a little bit and realized I didn't really touch on enough. This time I feel good about it, but I've hit 40 minutes. I think... Unfortunately, I think I must stop with this. I thought we would move through The Return and The Keys and start with part two next week, but maybe next week we will start, or we will finish up part one and we can do part two and see how far we get into it. As for this week, I think 40 minutes is probably plenty. So basically, if you enjoyed this, let me know. I didn't edit it. I'm just going to let you know that right now. Didn't edit it. Didn't really do much to it at all. Hopefully, we'll see if I can get my intro outro music in it, because I do love Kai Engel. K-A-I-E-N-G-E-L. That's how you spell his name. Look him up on Bandcamp. I should have links on the website for that. But look him up on Bandcamp. He makes some pretty awesome music. So hopefully I got that in here. We'll see. But I think that wraps it up for us. If you have any suggestions, any comments, any questions, anything like that, let me know. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks we can wrap this book up and we can start on the next project. The next book or manifesto. I'll give you that little hint. It is a manifesto. It is really well written too, by the way. We'll start on that one in a couple of weeks, hopefully. And but for now, I think that's it. I will talk to you guys next time. I hope you enjoyed, and just let me know. All right, bye-bye.